we're going to be hearing three bills today. The first two that are listed, the patent bill, the tobacco bill, minors tobacco bill, and 1536. 1531, the regulations on the marijuana dispensaries, and 1550, the speedy trial bill, will be heard on Monday. We're going to roll those over till Monday. Open a public hearing on House Bill 1540.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1540 was sponsored by Senator Winters and Representative Williamson. It passed through Senate Judiciary with a unanimous vote and unanimously across the House floor. It would prohibit a person from claiming a bad faith patent infringement and allows a person who has received a claim to bring an action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. It also allows a prosecuting attorney to investigate the claims and gives discretion to the court on factors to consider in bad faith claim determinations.
Okay, Aaron Knott. And John Chandler, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Department of Justice here in support of Senate Bill 1540A. We developed this concept in close collaboration with Senator Winters, and I wish she'd been able to make it today because she told a story on the Senate side that I think really drives home why this legislation is necessary. She had a constituent, a construction company, that got a demand letter accusing them of infringing on the patent of a company listed somewhere in Texas. And basically, they had been using fans to ventilate that construction site. And this letter explained in very vague terms that the use of that fan violated a patent that was being held by this Texas organization. They tried to get more information and really couldn't. They hit walls everywhere they looked. Specificity about what the patent was, where it came from, what it described, and the requirements for settlement that were being advanced by this Texas company were tremendously expensive, and this is a small, local-scale construction firm. It would have been ruinous for them. So they did the smart thing, went to their state senator and got this moving. We've been tracking the issue of what has been colloquially referred to as patent trolls, but I think the fairer term is patent aggregation entities, or PAEs, for some time. It's been the subject of multi-state litigation. The Attorney General pays attention to those, and I think we're looking at Oregon as a possible signatory in that area as well. The basic game goes like this. When I was sort of looking into patent trolls in the run-up to this hearing, there was one that was filed for, if I remember correctly, it was a thermal reconstitution methodology for bread. And that would have been patented. And, of course, thermal reconstitution methodology for bread is the making of toast. That's not the punchline. The punchline is that this patent was filed in 2000. And a lot of what we take for granted, particularly on the Internet, something like as simple as, say, a pop-up window, is subject to not one patent. It's subject to dozens or even hundreds of overlapping patents, many of which describe essentially the same mechanism in different ways. This has given rise to the patent aggregation entities, who essentially buy up as many of these patents as they can and then use them to file demand letters. Now, what's important to recognize about these, usually when you allege patent infringement, that's because you either made that patent, you used that patent has something to do with your business, and a competitor is using that patent to undercut you. And so you launch a claim for patent infringement, and you go forward in that way. That's not what these companies are doing. So Senate Bill 1540 represents a bipartisan, both-chamber attempt to get at this problem. This is, by my read, second in the nation legislation in the area of patent trolls. The first was Vermont, and I believe that came about in 2003. Basically, what this does is lay out some sort of broad parameters, and they're pretty easy to meet if you look at them, about how a company would demonstrate that they're operating in good faith rather than bad faith in the operation of a patent. And if you look at the good faith parameters, it really all you have to do, more or less, is show, and there are a number of ways statutorily that in which you can do this, that you have some use for this patent, that it bears some connection to your business, that you've successfully had claims around it before, and it's an intentionally low bar. We want you to have as many avenues as possible to demonstrate that you have a fair purpose for this patent. And then on the other side, the court is instructed to consider factors of bad faith. And bad faith is exactly the opposite. There's no relationship back to the business. The demand doesn't include any real information that you can use. The characteristics that we often call in context something like a robo-file, where you don't have a patent number, you don't have patent information, things of that sort. And I can go deeper into that if you'd like me to, but the bottom line is I believe that this is carefully tailored legislation that's really just trying to get at patent aggregation entities and bears very little risk of sweeping in anyone else. So I'll hold it there unless there are any questions for me.
Any questions? Okay, thank you, John.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of Senate Bill 1540A, and I may be able to add a little bit to Mr. Knott's story, because we are facing this exact situation. The construction industry is right now, I refer you to the testimony I put in on the Senate side, thanks to the marvels of the interweb, it should be in front of you. About a week and a half ago, I was blissfully unaware of both this bill and the issue generally, and at about noon, two Fridays ago, I became very aware and very interested, because builders all across Oregon received letters that Mr. Knott has described from a company, Savannah IP, asserting a patent. And in my letter, I point out, the letter said this: the patent covers conduct you are presently using or may use in the future for a moisture removal system. Savannah believes your present or contemplated use of a moisture removal system reads on this patent and therefore constitutes infringement. I submitted in the Senate side of the testimony, you'll see the copy of the patent, the copy of one of the letters one of my builders used, I received. The moisture removal system is the use of fans and heaters to dry out a house. Oregon code requires moisture in construction to be below a certain level. Most people, even lay people, even myself, recovering attorney, would sooner or later figure out if you want to dry out wood, you might run to fans and a heater. That's now apparently patented. In fact, the company is asserting that everything from the moisture testing process onward is subject to their patent, except for letting Mother Nature do it or running the furnace, which usually voids the furnace warranty and doesn't work. The license agreement being offered to builders is $150 a house. Sign here, initial there, and we'll let you off the hook. We won't sue you for patent infringement. Every house in Oregon, at least on the western side of the Cascade Mountains, uses this technique or something like it because it's wet. And if you build, you have to get the moisture out in order to meet the code. They intend to go this nationally. We have about 400, 500 of our builders have received these letters already. We've been in touch with our national association. I've been in touch with patent attorneys. What little intellectual property law I ever knew long since evaporated. But I do know that this bill would help us immensely while we're trying to get something done on the national level. Why the U.S. Patent Office issued this patent is beyond me. It's not too far off from toast. If I get some time after session, I'm going to patent carpentry or perhaps sweeping and be able to retire and not heckle you ever again. But this is a real present problem for my folks, because at $150 a pop, a lot of people are going to decide to just pay it rather than call their attorney and ask, because the attorney will charge them more than $150 to tell them whatever they're going to tell them. But it could run very rapidly into the many millions of dollars for the industry, even at $150 each. It is a very bad problem. I urge your support of this bill. I'll be happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Yes, Wayne.
Are you actually a recovering attorney?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I am. I keep getting about the 10th step, the 12th step program, and relapsing.
Nothing further. Thank you for your
testimony.
Thank you. Move to a work session on House Bill 1540A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 1540 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 1540 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion?
So the A7 amendments are not something we're interested in. Okay, clarify.
I don't think we are.
Okay.
So, is there any discussion? Are there any objections to the bill? Bill moves. Representative
Williams.
will be the hearing. Open a public hearing on House Bill, I mean, sorry, Senate Bill 1546. And if I said House Bill 1540, I meant Senate Bill 1540.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, Senate Bill 1546 was sponsored by Senator Shields. It passed out of the Senate Judiciary Committee on a 5-0 vote and across the floor with 29 ayes and one nay. This involves employees of an off-site sales licensee to sell liquor, such as a grocery store clerk who unknowingly or unintentionally sells alcohol to a minor while operating a checkout device. Currently, they are convicted of a Class A misdemeanor for a first offense. This would change it to a Class A violation for a first offense.
Okay, thank you. Kevin Billman, Beth Cook, and Jeff Anderson, please. I'll just go in the order. Please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Billman, and I am the Legislative and Community Affairs Director for the United Food and Commercial Workers Union Local 555. I am here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 1546A. You have a copy of a one-pager on OLIS. Under the current law, a grocery store clerk can be charged with a criminal Class A misdemeanor for an honest mistake, unintentionally or unknowingly selling alcohol to a minor. I say maybe because some, but not all, district attorneys charge this offense as a Class A violation. Unfortunately, this is not consistent throughout Oregon. This bill would reduce that penalty to a Class A violation on a first offense and provide consistency throughout the state. Currently, when a cashier is caught mistakenly selling alcohol to a minor, even if it is in a sting operation, by store policy, they are typically terminated from employment. With a criminal record, it is incredibly difficult to find new work in our industry. The result is the death penalty for employees in their chosen line of work, retail sales. To further clarify, the intent of this bill is to address unintentional or unknowing sales. Clerks who make these inadvertent sales would still be required to complete a mandatory OLCC-approved training course under existing statute. The presumptive first offense fine would be $435, a harsh punishment when you are making, on average, $12 to $14 an hour. I would like to thank the committee for your time and encourage you to vote yes on Senate Bill 1546A.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Beth Cook, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 1546A on behalf of the United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 555. You have a copy of written testimony from Sarah Demerit and Rochelle Rising. They were unfortunately not able to be here today in person, but I think, and I won't read their entire testimony, but it is important to highlight their stories because they represent so many cases throughout Oregon. Sarah spent more than 10 years working as a clerk in the same store. Rochelle spent more than 15. Both had exemplary employment records. Both made just one error and were charged with Class A misdemeanors. These charges resulted in not only the loss of their jobs, but their health care, their seniority, and the assessment of court fees. And Sarah asked me, why would I do that? I passed countless other stings in my career and stopped multiple attempts by minors to purchase alcohol. I would never intentionally have done this. Sarah and Rochelle are not alone in their experience. These are hardworking employees. There is no criminal intent. We recognize that it is important to provide punishment in these cases, and as Kevin has mentioned, there are mechanisms under this bill to provide that penalty. We feel Senate Bill 1546A provides a more proportional penalty for these offenses, and I urge your support.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Anderson. I'm Secretary Treasurer of UFCW Local 555. We have 20,000 members in our local, 16,000 primarily in the grocery retail industry. And this has been an issue that I've been working since 1995. A member of ours, a 54-year-old man in 1995, was terminated in an alcohol sting here in Salem. And he worked for the company for 23 years with an unblemished record. But the policy was based on what is called a public purpose strict liability argument, so that the employer felt that they had to terminate, whether there was somebody good or otherwise, that they would like to keep. The irony of that is the police cadets were under the Salem Police authority. It was my brother-in-law that was actually operating the sting, Mark Kellyer, and I know Representative Olson is familiar with Mark. And they were livid because they believe that doing the sting inoculates, and traditionally on a Thursday or a Wednesday before a Friday football game, that the clerks then were going to be more judicious, checking IDs, and somebody who has been stung is actually probably a better advocate of checking ID. Unaware that the policy was to literally terminate the employee. So it led to us moving to where we're hopeful today that through your committee you have the opportunity to correct what we think is an injustice in terms of somebody working in Oregon losing their job on a first offense on something of this nature. I really please ask that you do support this and move it to the floor, and I appreciate it. If you have any questions, I could answer.
Do you have any questions, Mr. Anderson? Mr. Krieger.
Talk to us about the self-check counters.
So the self-checkout clerks would be covered underneath. There was a previous amendment that removed specific language that would have not required them to take the OLCC-approved training class had they been gone through a sting, but they are. So they are covered under this measure, but they would not be. They would be required, as all other clerks would be, to take the OLCC-approved training class.
How many of these self-check counters might a employee be required to be monitoring at the same time, and what would be the distance and feet that they might be apart?
Yeah, the most that I've seen was a cashier overseeing 12 units in a large big box retail unit. They usually come in quads or four units of four, and there were three sets of four being operated by one person at that time. It varies. It proposes a different problem in some ways. We had brought a bill last session, and really we were trying to get at this greater bill. And so I think the irony of us bringing that to the attention, which we do believe is an issue in some regards, this expanded is actually where we were hopeful to go in the first place, to be a comprehensive solution that would not lead to terminations on a first offense.
Maybe just a comment. I understand the reason why we have these rules and the stings and that type of thing. But that's taking part in a private sector. Put that into a public employee. You got three police officers here. We're out on the road. If we miss a violation, someone gets killed, DUI, and we were there, are they going to come back and then terminate us because we missed that drunk driver? Some of this, I understand where we're trying to go, but this does give me some great concern. If you're going to allow alcohol to go through a self-check, you're looking for trouble. I mean, they're going to try it. They're going to even have people in my own mind come in and try to distract that person by asking them a question, get between them and a counter. We need to have a better discussion on this issue, and hopefully we'll get to that eventually.
Thank you. Okay, any further questions?
I have a question,
okay,
Council.
Please.
Council, sorry to put you on the spot. I have no issue with the intent of the bill. I just would, whenever you're tinkering with endangering welfare or minor statute, I want to make sure we get it right. There's some bad stuff in there, and I don't want to make it a violation unintentionally. Can you walk me through Section 1 of the bill? There's some pretty bad stuff in there that I'm pretty sure we're not trying to catch it.
There is. So Section 1 of the bill, Part 1, a person commits the crime, we're going to use the word offense, mm-hmm. just cleaning that up, of endangering welfare of a minor if the person knowingly, A, B, C, D, E.
Right.
Okay. E, if you look on page 2.
And we break up E, it seems like.
Mm-hmm. Yes, E is broken up. E is also referenced later in the measure as a violation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's calling out its own subsection there saying this is a violation when. So it's just
gotcha.
A clarification.
So A, B, and C are going to remain misdemeanors. They're going to remain crimes. And E if it's involving drug paraphernalia as opposed to tobacco. Got it.
Correct. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Okay, any further questions for this panel? Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did not sign up. Sean Miller, representing the Northwest Grocery Association, and we're neutral on Senate Bill 1546, but I do feel I just wanted to comment because I know particular issue has come up last session involving self-checkout devices. This particular bill doesn't involve that, and that therefore we're neutral, understanding the direction that they're heading with this legislation. But, you know, to answer Representative Krieger's question, I know the previous panel mentioned the most they've ever seen is 12. The average is normally 4 to 6, and so there are different lanes that run down. And those machines do lock up on all alcohol sales. So just like last session when we addressed this issue, or at least we're debating this particular issue, all alcohol sales, they lock up automatically in the scanner and then require the checker to come over, check ID, and override the system for the sale to continue. And so last session we were debating that particular issue. The OLCC, when looked into the number of either alcohol sale violations through a self-checkout, there really was none as compared to just the regular checkouts, because again they're required to do the same thing, check the ID, and it locks up so they can't actually leave and process the transaction without that face-to-face checker customer checking ID, just like you would in a normal line. And so I just wanted to get that on the record, because I know that issue does come up in the context of this particular bill, and therefore we're neutral with the bill, but obviously have concerns with addressing the self-checkout issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Eddie. Go ahead.
Sean, those suspensions, do they take place sometimes in the first violation or the firing of the employee for a violation, maybe they're 15 years, one sting, 15 stings they get through, and then all of a sudden, whatever happens.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, that has been a policy that's normally put in place in the collective bargaining agreement. So I know that's something that the union and the employers negotiate in the collective bargaining agreement. And under the current statute, since because of the penalty, it's a criminal offense within the store, essentially, that has led to a termination, and that's the policy. So again, I think this legislature can make decisions, policy decisions, on what crime that particular offense is on first-time sales. Again, that's all then brought into the negotiating table between the union and labor management and how to deal with that. So again, I know this bill doesn't get into the labor negotiations, but again, I think their goal is to affect, because you're decriminalizing that offense, and that's been the policy. But again, that's at the bargaining table, but that's their goal, and I think that's your decision as lawmakers on how to deal with that offense.
Paulo,
do you know any place else in either the private sector or public employees where a first violation misdemeanor could cost you your job?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I don't, and I something I can look into, but I don't have that information on hand.
Okay, any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Yeah, Mr. Anderson.
Air traffic controllers.
I guess. I want to apologize. Jeff Anderson, for the name, United Food and Commercial Workers. I've been a member of the local since 1976, and we have never had any collective bargaining over this issue because of the public purpose strict liability argument. I've been part of the industry through and through. It's never been negotiated at the table, to my knowledge, and I've been in those bargainings as a rank and file member, as a staffer, and as an executive officer. I just want to give clarity that this is not a collective bargaining, that it drives out of the public purpose of a strict liability argument. We've never, to my knowledge, ever seen anything cross the table saying we should negotiate this. I just want to give clarity because I respect Sean.
Just clarification. You're just clarifying it. Thank you very much. In just another way of comment, I would certainly hope that the food workers and the businesses can get together if this is reduced to a violation, because it doesn't make any sense to me. I can't see anybody to fire a good long-term employee over one mistake. That would seem like that would be as big a loss to the business as it would to the individual.
I might want to spank them a little bit, but I don't know if I'd fire them.
Yes, Representative Tomei.
I'm just unclear. So is it just the first violation?
It's a violation.
It's a violation. After that, it's a crime. Thank you.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections?
We have a work session.
We're moving to work session on Senate Bill 1546. Go ahead.
1546. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1546 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 1546 to the floor with the due pass. Now, are there any objections? Okay. Do a roll if anybody wants. Okay. I'll carry the bill. Okay, thank you. And then we'll switch dance partners here and open a work session. A hearing on Senate Bill 1536, Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1536A comes to you from the Oregon Judicial Department. We have Judge Abernathy and Leola McKenzie here to testify on behalf of the bill. It does two things. First off, you may remember Senate Bill 622 from the 2013 session that dealt with juvenile court records and who had access and who did not, and the two different files in there. This clarifies some of that, particularly as it relates to public defense providers and what they will have access to. Second part of the bill is a cleanup in Senate Bill 623, the adoption records. And what it does is clarify when a person who's under the age of 18, after they turn 18, what records they can see and when. You have the A4 amendments that just came in to you, and they basically are pretty straightforward. They substitute date of birth for age regarding in the confidential files, the chairman's amendments. We do not have the fiscal impact back on the A4s, but I would be shocked if it had a fiscal impact.
So we'd be ready to possibly introduce those if
we
go to work.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, you could adopt the amendments. You could have a hearing on the bill and then probably wait until next Monday when we get the final report.
Please go ahead in any order you wish. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Pamela Abernathy, former Marion County Circuit Court judge and now judge in residence for the juvenile court programs. We have submitted written testimony. I'm here with Lisa Norris Lampe, and she can answer any detailed questions. I'm here like a judge to give the 50,000 or maybe 100,000 foot view. Also at the table is Wendy Johnson. She's here to speak to Section 7 on behalf of the Oregon Law Commission. So with respect to all sections but 7, let me just summarize for you. This fix-it bill is intended to do 5 things primarily. The first and the main impetus for this fix-it bill was that Senate Bill 622, which I think you're basically familiar with, created, clarified, and streamlined the code revisions with respect to inspection and copying of juvenile court records. And in that bill, we inadvertently created 2 sets of rules, one for cases filed before January 2014 and one for cases filed after. Obviously, we don't want court clerks having to apply 2 sets of rules, so this fixes that. The other piece of Senate Bill 622 was to, for the first time, mandate that the trial courts maintain a record of the case and also a supplemental confidential file, which is what we used to call the social file, which we used to keep, but we weren't supposed to maintain it, and now we do. So that's a good thing. This clarifies that mandate only applies prospectively to the trial courts. So that is the first main fix. The second is this bill gives the court express authority to provide copies of audio or video recordings to various entities, and that's an important piece of what we do. The third, this gives the court express authority to grant county or statewide access. This is important, especially for OPDS, to allow those attorneys to do conflict checks, to fill in for one another, that sort of thing. And all of this is prompted, I should have said, by way of background, by the moving to the Odyssey system, to the e-court system. So a lot of these clarifications change in giving the court express authority is prompted by that move. The fourth is the Chief Justice, the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, or any presiding judge can grant access to juvenile court records for the purposes of research and evaluation, obviously without identifying information contained with that transfer of information. The fifth in this fix, Senate Bill 622 would allow judges to grant any other person access. Any other person the court determines should have access, could get access. And what this fix does is it postpones the operative date of those provisions to the post-signee die and sign-by date for the 2015 session, September 30th, 2015. The reason for that is there is pending litigation in Multnomah County about access, in that instance, by the Oregonian to certain juvenile court records, and this any other person provision is delayed so that we can put together a work group after the litigation is done and have everybody who has a piece of that determine what the standards ought to be that the Judicial Department should encourage judges to apply for that. And then the A4 amendment is in response to a concern by the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. We offer an amendment to revert this back to what was originally in the code. We had put in age instead of date of birth, really just to make this consistent with some provisions allowing access to information about delinquents. The Newspaper Association wants date of birth in, like it used to be, not age, because it gives them more information. That's what the A4 amendments are about. So that's the big overview. With that, I'm going to turn this over to Ms. Johnson to tell you about Section 7, and then Ms. Doris Lampe and I would be happy to answer questions on our piece of it.
Thank you, Judge. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Oregon Law Commission. As Judge Abernethy explained, last session you passed Senate Bill 622 and 623. 622 was the juvenile records bill, and you had a lot of folks all at the table last time, defense, prosecution, judges. It was a consensus bill. We were asked to weigh in on this bill as well, bring that work group in. Even though it's not a commission bill, that work group did meet and did review it and does support the bulk of what this bill is, which is the juvenile records technical fixes. There is, as Judge Abernethy explained in Section 7, there's also a fix on adoption records. That is a follow-up to Senate Bill 623. And again, last session you heard from the whole adoption community, adoptive parents, birth parents, and adoption attorneys and judges who do these adoption cases. That was also a consensus bill that passed unanimously. As the courts have worked on training materials and the forms and such to roll out this new law that clarifies, actually changes a lot of adoption records law before, you may remember that you had to have a motion and an order every time you wanted to get something out of the adoption file. And as we moved to e-court, that just wasn't going to be practical. And so the work group, as you heard that bill last session, laid out new rules that said who gets what and when. So the amendment in Section 7 is to clarify, as the courts have interpreted it, to put it back to what the work group actually wanted and what you heard in testimony. And it's only regarding one group of people. It's the generally the person who gives consent in adoption, which is the birth parent. We reference the statute generally to say if it's in this ACES statute, you don't get those records. The problem is that was, it has lots of context, so it has the name and the address, and we meant the birth parents to be able to get the name, meant basically the birth parents to get all of these records except for a few things that are unique to this now segregated portion of the record. And so the amendment really just spells it out. So if you're looking at page 16, you'll see that we deleted on lines 29 and 30 and lines 32 and 33 what was just really general, the pre-2014 and the after 2014. It just said the ACES statute and the exhibits, and we're now just spelling out that what that means for those cases before 2014 where there won't have been an ACES, the adoption summary and segregated information statement. So basically there are three exhibits that parents won't get: the home study, the adoption report, which goes to vital statistics, and the medical history, and then the things that are in that ACES, which are basically phone numbers, and we added social security numbers because we learned that later that you really do need to spell out social security numbers because they won't be redacted, even though we know they're not subject to public records law, because this would be accessed under this law rather than public records law. We need to specify that social security numbers won't be released. So it's just a cleanup, just to really further the work group's intent and what we believe the legislative intent was from our testimony. As I said, it is a consensus product. And then we have no position on, the commission doesn't take a position, but as I said, the work group supported, both work groups, the adoption group and the juvenile group, reviewed it and had and supported these changes.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions here? I want to thank you for the work you've done. And this is actually the kind of bill I always envisioned for a short session, was things that are cleaned up to make things right instead of some of the things we're doing. So thank you very much.
Okay. And Chair Barker,
yes,
if I may,
sure.
Lisa Norris-Lampe, staff attorney at the Oregon Supreme Court. I just wanted to mention for the committee that the written testimony that the department sent yesterday afternoon was based on the section numbering that was in the original Senate bill for okay. Senate Bill 1536. So we have sent over corrected testimony that refers to the new Section 7 and the renumbered 8 through 11. So if there was any confusion there, I apologize, and the corrected testimony will correct that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go to a work session on Senate Bill 1536 with the intention of admitting the Dash 4 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill, Senate Bill 1536.
Representative Barton moves the Dash 4 amendments in the House, in the Senate Bill 1536. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? The Dash 4s are in. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1536. Is there any further business today?
Mr. Chair, you want to move this bill, roll the bill over until Monday?
Yes, okay. Until we get the paperwork to catch up yes. on it. Thank you. Okay. No further business. We are adjourned. Thank you, committee. Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.